every spring. That was not the end. Only 8 months after the Bayou Corn sinkhole, the state issued a permit to drill once again in a massive new project in Lake Penure. It gave permission to the nation's largest distributor of natural gas, AGL Resources, to dredge the lake and drill 3 waste wells within which to deposit toxic waste. It granted permission to dig 3 additional wells to store natural gas, and another to drill for brine, all inside the salt dome underlying Lake Penure.
"Thank God they decided the salt dome wasn't okay to store nuclear waste," Mike declares.
Memory was short. The drilling company at Bayou Corn Sinkhole, 2012, had forgotten the disaster of Lake Penure, 1980. Now Lake Penure AGL Resources was forgetting, or overriding, both disasters. The cowboys were running the regulatory agency. Save Lake Penure and the Louisiana Environmental Action Network, LEAN, jointly sued the state. A state judge put a stay on drilling, and at this writing, the matter rests there. Alone at the dining table in his ruined home, Mike fired off a letter imploring a state senator to vote to ban, for a year, new permits to store hazardous waste and brine in underground cavities in salt domes until stricter guidelines were developed. It was aimed at stopping drilling in Lake Penure. The bill did not pass. Mike took on yet another big cause, the Louisiana Tea Party itself. Why couldn't they join a good fight? The coastal land of Louisiana had long been slowly sinking into the Gulf of Mexico. The state's coast provides 40% of the nation's wetlands, and its commercial fisheries provide a quarter to a third of the nation's seafood. Experts agree that a major cause of the land's subsidence is the extraction of oil and saltwater intrusion. Over the years, oil companies have dredged hundreds of canals and laid down pipeline through which oil drilled in the Gulf has been piped inland. Salt water seeps in along the canals, killing grasses that once provided protection against Louisiana's frequent tropical storms. Since 1930, the state had already lost an area equal to the size of Delaware, an average football field every hour. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, faced an astonishing new task: delisting coastal postal addresses. Gone is Yellow Cotton Bay, once a prime fishing settlement in Plaquemines Parish. Gone are Little Pasta Wharf and Skipback Bay. The church in Grand Bayou stands on stilts. A small cemetery is accessible only by boat. 31 communities are now listed only in the historical record. Residents of Ile de Jean Charles are the first climate refugees to receive federal help moving to dry land. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, the state legislature set up the Southeast Flood Control Commission to come up with a plan for protecting Louisiana from floods. They concluded that the best course of action was to fill in the canals and repair the shore. Since this was a task the oil companies had in their contracts agreed to do and had not done, in 2014 the commission did what had never been done. It sued the 97 responsible oil companies. Governor Jindal quickly squashed the upstart commission. He removed members from it. He challenged its right to sue. In another unprecedented move, the legislature voted to nullify, retroactively, the lawsuit by withdrawing the authority to file it from those who had done so. A measure, SB 553, called for costs of repairs to be paid not by the oil companies, but by the state's taxpayers. Mike saw his chance. Still writing from his dining room table in Bayou Corn, he addressed fellow members of the New Orleans-based Louisiana Tea Party.
Lower taxes!
Surely they would get behind this one, he thought, so he arranged to meet the group at the T.J. Ribs Steakhouse in Baton Rouge. But presented with the idea, the Tea Party faces went blank. The environment? That was a liberal cause. One man confused the Green Army with the Green Party. To Mike's astonishment, another member suggested moving the burden from the Louisiana taxpayer to the nation's taxpayers.
It was a total bust, he told me later. I'd invited the general, and I had to apologize to him for wasting his precious time.
Undaunted, Mike tried again with a different Tea Party gathering, this time in Ruston, in north-central Louisiana. Again he asked General Honoré, and again the general spoke, this time wearing his American flag and eagle necktie. The issue was saltwater intrusion into their drinking water, and this time party members listened.
Why leave the issue of the environment to the left? Mike argued. It should be our issue, too.
But how, I wondered, did that work? Putting care for the environment together with the Tea Party call to defund, if not abolish, the EPA, along with other agencies of government. Mike's answer was the free market.
Follow the money, he said. Make it in the financial interest of everyone to do the right thing. Texas Brine took risks, but it bought insurance. And that insurance company took out backup insurance. It's in the financial interest of those insurance companies to make sure accidents don't happen. Let them be the regulators.
Then he added,
the insurance companies need to be bonded.
Third-party guarantees promising to pay compensation if problems occur.
That will do it. All we need from the federal government are jails, courts, laws, and bonding. You regulate companies without federal regulators.
Interesting, I thought. But wait, wasn't this exactly the setup that led to the sinkhole disaster in the first place? Texas Brine was insured by a New York-based Liberty Insurance Company. Liberty was bonded, but it refused to pay and sued Texas Brine. Other companies insuring Texas Brine did the same, and it countersued them all. You had the courts, the laws, the jails, and bonding, and you had both an ecological and a legal mess. Besides, didn't rich companies hire many lawyers to come up against victims with one? I asked.
No, Mike countered. It's rich oil companies up against rich insurance companies.
Even so, don't you need another federal counterweight? I thought back to Lee Sherman's life at PPG, to the rubberized horse, to the industrial explosion that made the young Janice Areno think the world was ending, to the Areno's deceased relatives, dead animals, and missing frogs in Bayou Din, to the events leading up to the seafood advisory. I thought of life before the EPA, and all this in a state that had so much natural magnificence to protect. Donnie McCorkadale was right that some accidents were bound to happen, I thought. But without a national vision based on the common good, none of us could leave a natural heritage to our children, or, as the general said, be free. A free market didn't make us a free people, I thought. But I had slipped way over to my side of the empathy wall again. Mike agreed with a smidgen of this. A skeleton crew at the EPA, maybe. But the EPA was grabbing authority and tax money to take on a fictive mission, he felt, lessening the impact of global warming. This was just another excuse to expand, like governments do. As a whole, the federal government was eroding beloved communities, such as those he loved. And if the federal government was anything like the Louisiana state government, which he thought it wasn't worth believing in or paying taxes to. The federal government filled a mental space in Mike's mind, and the minds of all those on the right I came to know, associated with a financial sinkhole. In fact, after the 2009 government bailout of failing banks, companies, and homeowners, the federal government seemed to side with yet more line cutters. Now, debtors, too, were cutting ahead of people, and the federal government was inviting them to do so. This was a strange new expression of social conflict, undeclared, appearing on a new stage, with various groups undefined by class per se, blacks, immigrants, refugees, mixed in. And by proxy, the federal government was the enemy. And on the personal side, there was one more thing. The federal government wasn't on the side of men being manly. Liberals were certainly on the wrong side of that one. It wasn't easy being a man. It was an era of numerous subtle challenges to masculinity, it seemed. These days, a woman didn't need a man for financial support, for procreation, even for the status of being married. And now, with talk of transgender people, what really was a man? It was unsettling. Wrong. At the core, to be a man, you had to be willing to lose your life in battle, willing to use your strength to protect the weak. Who today was remembering all that? Marriage was truly between a man and a woman, Mike felt. Clarity about one's identity was a good thing, and the military had offered that clarity, he felt, even as it offered gifted men of modest backgrounds a pathway to honor. Meanwhile, the nearly all-male areas of life, the police, the fire department, parts of the U.S. military, and the oil rigs, needed defending against this cultural erosion of manhood. The federal government, the EPA, stood up for the biological environment, but it was allowing, and it seemed at times it was causing, a cultural erosion. What seemed to my Tea Party friends to be dangerously polluted, unclean, and harmful was American culture. And against that pollution, the Tea Party stood firm. Mike was a fighter, but not a cowboy, a man of religion, but not a worshiper, and a team loyalist, but critical in one big way of his team. The team he wanted would dismantle much of the federal government that he blamed for many wrongs in America. He still saw the solution to many problems as non-governmental. But in his hour of need, faced with the Bayou Corn sinkhole, he had called on the EPA to check the level of methane gas in his neighborhood. While Mike thought we needed policemen to protect the streets, he wasn't so sure about the EPA protecting the waterways. It could get too bossy. It could get too big. At night, after the evacuation of most of the Bayou Corn sinkhole victims, he said, "I go out to look at the stars, and all the houses are dark." In the year before Mike moved, a scattering of other residents had also stayed on in their destroyed homes. One was a neighbor and dear friend, Randy, whose wife was facing her third bout with breast cancer. She was suffering from radiation treatments, and Randy felt it unwise to move her. One evening, Mike looked across Crawfish Stew Street and saw Randy standing on his lawn alone. He was smoking a cigarette, spirals of smoke drifting upward into the empty night. He'd lost his house to the sinkhole. His wife was ill. Their dog was dying. "But I sensed he was feeling bad about something new," Mike said. "So I walked across the street over to him. He's just gotten word that his son had pancreatic cancer." Mike put his hand on Randy's shoulder, and the two men wept together for a long time. Part 4. Going National. 14. The Fires of History. The 1860s and the 1960s. Stepping back in time, three streams of influence seemed present in the feelings of my Tea Party friends in Louisiana. One often spoken of, and two rarely. For one thing, the Tea Party movement is one in a long line of periodic heightened expressions of a popular impulse endemic in American political culture, as the historian Richard Hofstadter has noted. Through the 19th and 20th centuries, movements rose up against secularism, modernity, racial integration, and a culture of experts. But none before the Tea Party have so forcefully taken up the twin causes of reversing progressive reform and dismantling the federal government. A movement in response to the deep story. So within the long line of such movements, why this one? To answer that, we must look to two pivotal moments in history, I believe. One is the era of the 1860s, which has special meaning for the South. The second is the era of the 1960s, which resonates for the right wing across the nation. The contemporary turn to the right in America has occurred mainly in the South, which is what drew me there. You don't have to be Southern to be Tea Party, of course, but the white South has been a center of it. What interests me about Southern history is the series of emotional grooves, as we might call them, carved into the minds and hearts of the people I came to know through the lives of their ancestors, many of whom were white farmers of small farms. It isn't the origin of certain ideas in history that I am curious about, as much as the way the past fixes patterns of class identification in our minds that we impose on the present. What might people be asked to want to feel, to believe they should feel, to actually feel? In broad, sketching strokes, what might be the impact of stories from grandparents, teachers, and history books on the ideas of those I've come to know? The 1860s. The South had become a section apart, in C. Van Woodward's words, because of the plantation system. This system deeply affected well-to-do white planters and black slaves, of course, but it also left a deep imprint on another large group we often forget, poor white sharecroppers, small farmers, and tenant farmers, some of whom were the ancestors of those I came to know in Louisiana. In his classic, The Mind of the South, W.J. Cash says that the plantation system threw up walls which enclosed the white man, walls he did not see. The poor white did not see himself locked into a marginal life, but as a potential planter or mill baron himself. Within those walls, the cultural imagination focused intently on two groups, the dominant and dominated. Very rich and very poor, free and bound, envied and pitied, with very little in between. Rich planters sipped foreign wine under crystal chandeliers, seated on European chairs in white-pillared mansions. They saw themselves not as wicked oppressors, but as generous benefactors, and poor whites took them as such. At the other extreme, poor whites saw the terrifying misery of the traumatized, short-lived slave. This set in their minds a picture of the best and worst fates in life. Compared to life in New England farming villages, there was much more wealth to envy above, and far more misery to gasp at below. Such a system suggested its own metaphoric line waiting for the American dream. One with little room for the lucky ahead, and much room for the forgotten behind. Between this top and bottom, Cash describes poor whites as living in unpainted houses with sagging rail fences and crazy barns which yet bulged with corn. However, as the plantation system grew, it became harder and harder to cope. Planters bought up the most desirable fertile plains, pressing poorer farmers onto the barren uplands. If poor white farmers tried to move to better land, they found that the planters had seized the best lands there, even beyond the Mississippi, in Arkansas and Texas, armed with plentiful capital and solid battalions of slaves. Poor whites were driven back to the Red Hills and the sand lands and the pine barrens and the swamps, to all the marginal lands of the South. To plant cotton and sugarcane, plantation owners destroyed forests, which deprived the farmer's table of the old abundant variety, reducing his diet to corn pone and the flesh of razorback hogs. Since the planters relied on slave labor, and since they bought most of their hay, corn, beef, and wood from the North or Midwest, poor whites became surplus labor, left to live on what they themselves could produce. Marginalized and without demand for their labor, poor whites bore up under rude epithets: crackers, white trash, po' buckra. Transposing ancestral history onto our modern-day deep story, 19th-century poor whites stood very far back in line for the American dream. There was no ethnic or gender parade of people cutting in. The very idea of redistribution was anathema to the plantation system. And there was little by way of a government-supported public commons, the South being far poorer than the North in public libraries, parks, schools, universities. Then came the Civil War, and the North devastated the South. Cities were burned, fields laid waste, some by the Confederate troops as they retreated. After the Civil War, the North replaced Southern state governments with its own hand-picked governors. The profit-seeking carpetbaggers came, it seemed to those I interviewed, as agents of the dominating North. Exploiters from the North, an angry, traumatized black population at home, and moral condemnation from all, this was the scene some described to me. When the 1960s began sending freedom riders and civil rights activists pressing for new federal laws to dismantle Jim Crow, there they came again, it seemed, the moralizing North. And again, Obamacare, global warming, gun control, abortion rights. Did these issues, too, fall into the emotional grooves of history? Does it feel like another strike from the North, from Washington, that has put the brown pelican ahead of the Tea Party or waiting in line, I wondered. When I talked to Cappy Brantley in Longville about the 2016 presidential election, he commented with a gentle smile, "Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, they're from the North." A different costume. From Baton Rouge to New Orleans, the great sugarcane plantations border both sides of the river all the way, standing so close together for long distances, Mark Twain wrote in Life on the Mississippi, that the broad river lying between the two rows becomes a sort of spacious street. Along the 70-mile strip, some 400 graceful mansions with two- or three-story white Grecian pillars, oak-canopied walkways, manicured gardens, and ponds are the ancient castles of America. They were built with profits from cotton. The new cotton is oil, but the plantation culture continues. Indeed, a number of the white-pillared mansions of the great plantations have now been bought by oil and petrochemical companies. Dow Chemical bought 4 plantations, including the Australia Plantation and the Abner Jackson Plantation, and on the latter the company hosts conferences in its big house. "We've always been a plantation state," Oliver Houck, a Tulane University law professor, observes. "What oil and gas did is replace the agricultural with an oil plantation culture." Like cotton, oil is a single commodity, requiring huge investment, and has, like cotton and sugar, come to dominate the economy. The parallel between cotton and oil has its limits, of course. Cotton barons did not promise prosperity to poor farmers or slaves, as the oil industry has done to modern-day Louisianans. On the positive side, oil offers to restore lost honor. For if the plantation system brought shame to the South in the eyes of the nation, oil has brought pride. The hosannas of the Louisiana Chemical Association are expressed in the language of investment, profit, and jobs. But the new plantation seems to offer more. The big house without the slave quarters. Meanwhile, just as yeoman farmers were pressed back to make way for the sugar and cotton plantations, so too has oil partly crowded out the seafood industry and tourism, as Paul Templet noted. That also happened to a talkative man whom I discovered on one summer visit, a man sweating in his woolen Confederate cap and uniform as he worked as a period actor at the restored Oak Alley Plantation. This was the grandest of the majestic mansions along River Road, now a popular tourist attraction. He was stationed in a small tent behind the big house. Displayed was a Civil War-era rifle, and on a hanger a Confederate uniform, cap, and knapsack. A friendly blonde man in his 40s, he was paid to talk about the details of his make-believe life as a Confederate soldier of the 1860s, and he was doing a convincing job. At the moment, there were no others in his tent. He invited me to sit down with him at a small table and talk. He set aside his prepared script to tell me, "Oil is the new cotton. I was born 8 miles from here. My wife and I raise racehorses on an 8-acre farm. An oil company applied for permission to set up a tank farm half a football field away from our house. An enormous storage facility that holds up to 46 million barrels of crude oil. And we couldn't stop it. No one could. We can't sell our house either because the value of it sank because now we're next to a tank farm." Then the man looked around casually as if to check if he could be overheard. "I'm here in my costume to represent a Confederate trooper. Confederates tried to get out from under the control of the federal government. To secede. But you can't secede from oil, and you can't secede from a mentality. You have to think your way into and out of that mentality. But they should get me in a different costume to talk about that." Echoes from the 1960s and 1970s. A century later, another legacy was to fuel the right, not just in the South, but across the nation. The 1960s and 1970s set off a series of social movements, which to some degree shuffled the order of those waiting in line and laid down a simmering fire of resentment which was to flame up years later as the Tea Party. During this era, a long parade of the underprivileged came forward to talk of their mistreatment. Blacks who had fled a Jim Crow South, underpaid Latino field workers, Japanese internment camp victims, ill-treated Native Americans, immigrants from all over. Then came the women's movement, overburdened at home, restricted to clerical or teaching jobs in the workplace, unsafe from harassment, women renewed their claim to a place in line for the American dream. Then gays and lesbians spoke out against their oppression. Environmentalists argued the cause of forest animals without forests. The endangered brown pelican, flapping its long, oily wings, had now taken its place in line. As the 1960s transitioned to the 1970s, a movement focused on the social and legal system shifted into a movement focused on personal identity. Now, to gain public sympathy, it was enough to be Native American, or a woman, or gay. The patience of many on both left and right was tried. All these social movements left one group standing in line, the older white male, especially if such a man worked in a field that didn't particularly help the planet. He was, or was soon becoming, a minority, too. If the civil rights movement and the women's movement had pointed the finger of blame at the entitled white male, maybe it was time for people to see white men as victims, too, to be heard, honored, and put or left ahead in line. But this provided its members with a troubling contradiction. How do you join the identity politics parade and also bring it to a halt? Perhaps the defining moment of the 1960s occurred in the South, which had remained the most conservative area of the country and the least prepared for the enormous changes that began in June of 1964, Freedom Summer. 1,000 students, many from elite universities, traveled to Mississippi to register voters, teach black history, and help in what ways they could. My husband Adam and I were among them. 60 civil rights workers were trained in voter registration in Plaquemine, Louisiana. Even though most black voter applicants were turned away, over 1,000 got registered for the first time in their lives. Black students famously tried to integrate lunch counters, restaurants, hotels, housing, schools, and universities. Especially for blacks, this was dangerous work. In the summer of 1964, 3 voter registration drive workers, 1 black and 2 white, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in Philadelphia, Mississippi. This led to a national outcry and to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. There were 1,062 arrests, 37 churches were burned or bombed, and the homes or businesses of 30 blacks were also bombed or burned. This was also the year the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation to the Democratic National Convention challenged the all-white regular delegation. Where did this leave white, blue-collar Southern men, the most visible resistors to civil rights? In the shocked eyes of the nation, they lost moral standing. Many older males I spoke with were children or teenagers in the 1960s. Whatever their family's view or their own, however much sympathy they may have personally felt for blacks at the time, the public narrative was that the North had to come to the South, as it had with soldiers in the 1860s and during Reconstruction in the 1870s, to tell Southern whites to change their way of life. History was on the side of the civil rights movement. The nation honored its leaders. Southern whites bore the mark of shame again, even though, as one man told me, we didn't do those bad things. Even though the federal government had been an instrument of racial segregation in the past, it now stood for racial equality. A slow drumroll began. In 1948, President Harry S. Truman integrated the armed services. In 1954, the Supreme Court, through Brown v. Board of Education, integrated schools. In 1959, President Dwight D. Eisenhower sent in federal troops and the National Guard to enforce federal law integrating schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. And that set the stage for more federal action in the decade to follow. In 1962, President John F. Kennedy sent 5,000 federal troops to ensure the right of James Meredith to attend the University of Mississippi. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the most sweeping civil rights law since Reconstruction. This was followed by an executive order for government contractors instituting affirmative action for minorities in employment. In 1968, Johnson banned discrimination in housing. And so it went. The federal government aiding a social movement of a people to take their rightful place in line for the American dream. The feminist movement followed the civil rights movement, picking up from earlier struggles for the right to vote, hold office, and own property in one's own name. a series of legal decisions strengthening the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment were now applied in places of work that received any money from the federal government. Later, the movement for gay rights trod the same path through the 1970s. Over time, new groups were added to older ones, and political and therapeutic cultures merged. Identity politics was born. Identities based on surviving cancer, rape, childhood sexual abuse, addiction to alcohol, drugs, sex work. These and more came to the media's attention. It became a race for the crown of thorns, the critic Todd Gitlin, a former 1960s activist, lamented in his book, The Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Racked by Culture Wars. On the heels of these movements for social change, a certain culture of victimization had crept in. And where did that leave the older white male? As an ideal, fairness seemed to stop before it got to him. Struggle for honor. My Tea Party friends, and many now did feel like friends, responded to the fire of the 1960s by incorporating some parts of its message and resisting others. One woman told me she loved Sarah Palin because she was a pro-life feminist who embraced girl power and mama grizzlies. Another honored Martin Luther King Jr. as the model of level-headed leadership, in contrast to the youthful urban hotheads who break store windows in rage at police brutality. But they also had strong objections to some outcomes of the movements of the 1960s. If you have one drop of Native American blood, you qualify under some affirmative action guideline to get financial aid for college. But why does that put you ahead in line, they wondered. If a person said he or she was white, as a way of describing themselves in the manner of the Native American or black, they risked being seen as racist soldiers of the Aryan nation. If they stood up to declare themselves proud to be male, unless they were part of a men's group trying to unlearn traditional ways, they risked being seen as male chauvinists. If they called for recognition for their lifetime of experience, their age, they risked seeming like old fools in a culture focused on youth. Putting the 1860s and the 1960s together, white men of the South seemed to have lived through one long, deep story of being shoved back in line. If in the 19th century the big planters had reduced the lot of the poor white farmer, 21st century corporations had gone global, automated, moved plants to cheaper workers, or moved cheaper workers in, and deftly remained out of sight over the brow of the hill. Some 280 of the most profitable American companies had dodged taxes on half of their profits, according to a 2011 study. But in the history-soaked deep story, you couldn't see that. You were left to imagine it, to feel you couldn't do anything about it. And to make matters worse, it was your sector, the free market, that was letting you down. Meanwhile, white wages leveled or sank, and welfare expenditures rose. The honor squeeze. So, for older white men, the 1960s presented a delicate dilemma. On one hand, they did want to stand up, come forward, and express an identity like so many others had done. Why not us, too? On the other hand, as members of the right, they had objected in principle to cutting in line and disliked the overused word victim. Still, and this was unsayable, they were beginning to feel like victims. Others had moved forward. They were the left behind. They disliked the word suffer, but they had suffered from wage cuts, the dream trap, and the covert dishonor of being the one group everyone thought stood unfairly ahead of the line. Culturally speaking, the entire North had cut in, and seemed to move the south to the back of the line. Even as, and this was forgotten, federal dollars had steadily moved from north to south. How, again, could the white male openly want to cut in line himself when he objected, in principle, to cutting in line? He was in conflict and responded to it by seeking honor in other ways. First, he would claim pride in work. But work had become less and less secure, and again, wages for the bottom 90% remained flat. Word was out that some workers at Toys R Us and Disneyland were being asked to train other workers destined to replace them for less pay. And the federal government was giving money to people who did no work, undercutting the honor accorded work itself. But see Appendix C. If he couldn't take pride in work, the Tea Party man tried region and state. And there, too, he ran into difficulty. Most people I talked to loved the South, loved Louisiana, loved their town or bayou. But they were sadly aware of its low status. "Oh, we're the flyover state," one Tea Party teacher told me. "We're seen as backward and poor," another complained. Like red-leaning Midwestern farmers who felt insulted to be called hayseeds, or Appalachian coal miners who were seen as hillbillies, as residents of their region, Southerners had taken an ill-deserved hit in the eyes of the nation. If region and state couldn't serve as a basis for honor, surely strong family values could. Even when they couldn't manage to live up to their moral code, which favored lifelong, heterosexual, monogamous, pro-life marriage, they took pride in the code itself. It was not easy to live by such a code. One woman of the right had a gay brother who had been married, had a child, and abandoned both just because of sex, and the episode had caused an upheaval in the family. In order to avoid the pain of divorce her own parents had caused her, one woman entered a covenant marriage. Intended to strengthen the institution, covenant marriage was passed into law in Louisiana in 1997, and later in Arkansas and Arizona. It calls on the couple to sign an affidavit that they have undergone premarital counseling and otherwise heightens the requirements for entry and exit from marriage. She soon discovered her husband was gay, and while the couple later cooperated in raising their two children, she was glad she had tried to keep the marriage together the way it should be. The 14-year-old daughter of another mother became pregnant and kept the baby. "I'm working full-time and she's got to finish school. Frankly, it's been very hard." And it would have been easier for her young daughter, she feels, if she had had an abortion. But there was honor in keeping the baby and doing the right thing. An honor they felt to be invisible to liberals. And church. Many, like Janice Areno, spoke of the value of being churched and giving tithes. But some of the beliefs they learned in church, that the earth was made in 7 days, that heaven was a giant cube, that Eve was born of Adam's rib, that evolution never occurred, were, if taken literally, seen in the eyes of a wider, more secular world as signs of a poor education. But being Christian and taking Jesus as your Savior was, for Janice, Jackie, Madonna, and others, a way of saying, "I commit myself to being a moral person. I daily try to be good, to help, to forgive, and in fact, to work hard at being good." "If I know a person is a Christian," one woman told me, "I know we have a lot in common. I'm more likely to trust that he or she is a moral person than I would a non-Christian." Underlying all these other bases of honor, in work, region, state, family life, and church, was pride in the self of the deep story. The people I came to know had sacrificed a great deal and found honor in sacrifice. It had been hard for Janice Areno's father to drop out of school to help his dad raise a family of 10, Although nearly everyone I spoke to had two children, three at most, and some none at all, a few honored their mothers or grandfathers for having raised very large families. It was a hard thing to do. They took pride in giving to local community. Mike Schaff's two beers sandbagging against flood, Janice's friends' one-touch pillows for American troops, Jackie Tabor's work at Abraham's tent. What seemed like a problem to liberals, the fact that conservatives identify up with the 1%, the planter class, was actually a source of pride to the Tea Party people I came to know. It showed you were optimistic, hopeful, a trier. It wasn't a problem that you seldom looked behind you in line. Why would you want to blame a guy if he got all the way to the top, they wondered. That gaze forward, even when matters seemed hopeless, was a feature of the brave, deep-story self. But such a self was less and less a source of honor, it seemed. Rising to the fore was another kind of self, a more upper-middle-class, cosmopolitan self, with its more dispersed and looser friendship networks, its preparation to compete for entrance to big-name colleges and tough careers that might take a person far from home. Such cosmopolitan selves were directed to the task of cracking into the global elite. They made do with living farther away from their roots. They were ready to go when opportunity knocked. They took great pride in liberal causes, human rights, racial equality, and the fight against global warming. Many upper-middle-class liberals, white and black, didn't notice what, emotionally speaking, their kind of self was displacing. For along with blue-collar jobs, a blue-collar way of life was going out of fashion. And with it, the honor attached to a rooted self and pride in endurance. The deep-story self. The liberal upper-middle class saw community as insularity and closed-mindedness, rather than as a source of belonging and honor. And they didn't see that, given trends, behind the brow of the hill, their turn to be displaced might be next. For the Tea Party around the country, the shifting moral qualifications for the American dream had turned them into strangers in their own land. Afraid, resentful, displaced, and dismissed by the very people who were, they felt, cutting in line. The undeclared class war, transpiring on a different stage, with different actors, and evoking a different notion of fairness, was leading those engaged in it to blame the supplier of the imposters, the federal government. Syrian refugees. With the arrival in 2015 of Syrian refugees to the United States, fleeing the flames of war at home, one more set of faces seemed to my Tea Party informants to be pulling ahead in line, and they were dangerous besides. Lee Sherman saw the Syrians as potential members of ISIS. 90% of them are men, and I think we ought to put them in Guantanamo, he said. But they aren't enemy combatants, I reminded him. I know, but you can take the fences down, make it less like a prison, he replied. If you let them into the U.S., they will have all our rights to things. Comparing the refugees to Southerners during the Civil War, Mike Schaff, himself a refugee from the Bayou Corn sinkhole, said, General Lee led brave Southerners, who, though grossly outnumbered and woefully underarmed, refused to flee their country as refugees. They stayed, fought, and many died. Their wives and children, many raped and murdered, also stayed to care for their homes. After their defeat, again, they did not flee. They stayed to eventually reshape our government. The Syrians should stay. Take a stand and fight for what they believe in. If you flee, in my mind, you're a traitor unto yourself. This is harsh, I know, but sometimes we have to make tough choices. Jackie Tabor said, We are protecting Muslims and persecuting Christians. Have you ever seen a Muslim charity event for people in need? Or soup kitchen for the homeless? A Muslim Thanksgiving? Where is the Muslim name on the Declaration of Independence? If Mike saw the Syrian refugees through the eyes of the 1860s, Jackie saw the official welcome offered them as more 1960s-style diversity, which threatened the core of the religious culture she held sacred. As strangers in their own land, Lee, Mike, and Jackie wanted their homeland back, and the pledges of the Tea Party offered them that. It offered them financial freedom from taxes, and emotional freedom from the strictures of liberal philosophy and its rules of feeling. Liberals were asking them to feel compassion for the downtrodden in the back of the line, the slaves of society. They didn't want to. They felt downtrodden themselves and wanted only to look up to the elite. What was wrong with aspiring high? That was the bigger virtue, they thought. Liberals were asking them to direct their indignation at the ill-gotten gains of the overly rich, the planters. The right wanted to aim their indignation down at the poor slackers, some of whom were jumping the line. One cultural contribution the South has made to the modern national right may be its persistent legacy of secession. In the 19th century, the secession was geographic. The South seceded from the North. Between 1860 and 1865, the 11 Confederate states established themselves as a separate territory and nation. The modern-day Tea Party enthusiasts I met sought a different separation, one between rich and poor. In their ideal world, government would not take from the rich to give to the poor. It would fund the military and the National Guard, build interstate freeways, dredge harbors, and otherwise pretty much disappear. So in the Tea Party idea, North and South would unite. But a new cleavage would open wide. The rich would divorce the poor, for so many of them were cutting in line. In the 1970s, there was much talk of President Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, which appealed to white fear of black rise, and drove whites from the Democratic Party to the Republican. But in the 21st century, a Northern strategy has unfolded, one in which conservatives of the North are following those of the South, in a movement of the rich and those identified with them, to lift off the burden of help for the underprivileged. Across the whole land, the idea is, handouts should stop. The richer around the nation will become free of the poorer. They will secede. 15. Strangers no longer. The power of promise. Normally, when doing field research, a sociologist comes to a scene, then leaves it, and the scene itself remains unchanged. By my 10th visit with my core of white, middle-aged, and older, Christian, married, blue and white-collar Louisianans, I had discovered that virtually everyone I talked to embraced the same feels-as-if deep story. But by the end of my research, there had been a profound change. With a Tea Party enthusiast, I drove to the rally at the lakefront airport in New Orleans of a rising Republican presidential candidate. Once back home, I checked in with my new friends and acquaintances to see how they felt about Donald J. Trump. Looking back at my previous research, I see that the scene had been set for Trump's rise, like kindling before a match is lit. Three elements had come together. Since 1980, virtually all those I talked with felt on shaky economic ground, a fact that made them brace at the very idea of redistribution. They also felt culturally marginalized. Their views about abortion, gay marriage, gender roles, race, guns, and the Confederate flag all were held up to ridicule in the national media as backward. And they felt part of a demographic decline. There are fewer and fewer white Christians like us, Madonna had told me. They'd begun to feel like a besieged minority. And to these feelings they added the cultural tendency, described by W.J. Cash in The Mind of the South, though shared in milder form outside the South, to identify up the social ladder with the planter, the oil magnate, and to feel detached from those further down the ladder. All this was part of the deep story. In that story, strangers step ahead of you in line, making you anxious, resentful, and afraid. A president allies with the line cutters, making you feel distrustful, betrayed. A person ahead of you in line insults you as an ignorant redneck, making you feel humiliated and mad. Economically, culturally, demographically, politically, you are suddenly a stranger in your own land. The whole context of Louisiana, its companies, its government, its church and media, reinforces that deep story. So this, the deep story, was in place before the match was struck. The doors to the Lakefront Airport hangar in New Orleans open at 3 p.m., and the former reality television star and Republican candidate for president, Donald J. Trump, is scheduled for 6 p.m., and arrives some half an hour later. It is the day before the Louisiana presidential primary vote. Enthusiastic fans descend from buses that have carried them from far-flung parking lots to join those walking on foot to pass through security. Red, white, and blue strobe lights slowly glide sideways and up, around the enormous space, as if to encircle the enchanted crowd with a feeling of ascendance. Milling about inside the hangar are 2,000 or 3,000 fans in Trump hats, or wearing Trump shirts, holding and waving signs. "Trump, make America great again," or "Silent majority stands with Trump." In front, an enormous American flag is draped against the wall. Nearly everyone is white. Apart from protesters, the only blacks I see are security guards or vendors hawking Trump t-shirts, $20 for one, $35 for two, on the lawn outside the hangar. People wear red, white, and blue caps. Men in beards and ponytails wave signs. A large, grizzled man in blue jeans and a checked shirt, with long gray hair flowing down his back, wanders about, an enormous American flag draped over one arm. Parents hold children on their shoulders. Another man in red and white striped pants stalks about in a tall hat. A young man wraps himself in an enormous American flag. Two men are wearing green shirts with the image of a $100 bill printed on them. Is this ironic or earnest? Or both? It is hard to tell. Throngs of 2,000 or 3,000 mill about looking to the stage. Loud music is playing. The Rolling Stones' "You Can't Always Get What You Want." The roving strobe light stops. Donald Trump climbs steps to the podium in front of the flag, turns, smiles, and waves to the excited crowd on all sides of him. A cheer breaks out. "Who dat say they gonna beat dat Trump? Who dat?" Adapting a spectator chant for the New Orleans Saints football team. Trump thanks the crowd and begins by describing his ascent to power. "I started at 7%, and they thought I'd wipe out. Then I got 15%, and then 25%. His talk of "I" moves to "we." "We're on the rise. America will be dominant, proud, rich. I am just the messenger." People hoot and shout. They pump their signs frantically up and down and wave them sideways. "We're not going to let other countries rip us off," Trump yells. Cheers. "We're not going to let it happen." Cheers. "Our country is going to hell, but we're going to make it great again." Cheers. "We're going to build a high wall, and Mexico's going to pay for it." Cheers. "We're going to build up our military." Roar.
We're going to knock the hell out of ISIS.
Another roar. A wiry older man in a black suit with a red tie holds up a sign. KKK for Trump. And flips it over to reveal Trump Duke for 2016. At first I think he is a protester, but looking at his face more closely, surmise he's KKK. He flicks a security guard away with his arms, but is finally escorted out. Black Lives Matter protesters also appear, having marched in along with other protesters whose signs say things like, "This vet is not for Trump. Small hands, small heart. No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA." Seeing these, Trump orders security, pointing to a man. "Get that guy out. Get him out." Others in the crowd point to the dissenter. "Out." "Why is this taking so long? I can't believe it's taking this long," Trump repeats, pointing to the protester. Then, drowning out the protesters, the crowd erupts. "USA! USA! USA!" In later sites of protest, Trump himself initiates the USA chant. Dissent is one thing, the implication is, but being American is another. After Trump's speech, the music resumes. Elton John's Rocket Man. Trump lingers to sign posters, hats, shirts, and boots. A small, distressed boy with Trump-like, moussed blonde hair is handed to the candidate by proud parents to be photographed. A short woman in a red hat struggles frantically to see over the heads of taller fans, finally standing on a chair, her arms on the shoulders of a stranger who steadies her. I see a middle-aged man, arms uplifted, as in the rapture, saying to those around him, and no one in particular, "To be in the presence of such a man." The next day, Donald Trump wins 41% of Louisiana's Republican primary vote, beating his evangelical rival, Ted Cruz. In speeches to large, excited crowds over the days to come, Trump tells his fans what he offers them. "I've been greedy. I'm a businessman. Take, take, take. Now I'm going to be greedy for the United States." Wild cheers. He also draws a clear dividing line between Christians, to whom he promises the return of Christian public culture on one hand, and Muslims and protesters holding Black Lives Matter signs on the other. Some protesters he refers to as bad, bad people. They do nothing. You hear that weak voice out there? That's a protester. They aren't protesters. I call them disruptors. In other speeches, Trump said, in reference to a protester, "I'd like to punch him in the face." February 23, 2016. "In the good old days, they'd have ripped him out of that seat so fast." February 27, 2016. "Knock the crap out of him, would you? Seriously, I promise you I will pay for the legal fees. I promise, I promise." February 1, 2016. "Some are very violent. Let's ruin, they're going to ruin the rest of their lives. If they want to do this, let them have a big arrest mark. Their lives are going to be ruined. I'll press charges." March 13, 2016. Later, Trump said of a man who tried to rush him on stage, "The man got taken down." Speculating on how he himself would have responded had the man reached him, Trump said, "I would have gone bump, bump, bump." He imitates pummeling the man. And on the issue of pollution that had so plagued the lives of the people of Louisiana, what would Donald Trump do about that? He said of the EPA, "We're going to get rid of it in almost every form." Cheers. Trump is an emotions candidate. More than any other presidential candidate in decades, Trump focuses on eliciting and praising emotional responses from his fans rather than on detailed policy prescriptions. His speeches, evoking dominance, bravado, clarity, national pride, and personal uplift, inspire an emotional transformation. Then he points to that transformation.
"We have passion," he told the Louisiana gathering. "We're not silent anymore. We're the loud, noisy majority."
He derides his rivals in both parties for their inability to inspire enthusiasm.
"They lack energy."
Not only does Trump evoke emotion, he makes an object of it, presenting it back to his fans as a sign of collective success. His supporters have been in mourning for a lost way of life. Many have become discouraged, others depressed. They yearn to feel pride, but instead have felt shame. Their land no longer feels their own. Joined together with others like themselves, they now feel hopeful, joyous, elated. The man who expressed amazement, arms upheld, to be in the presence of such a man seemed in a state of rapture. As if magically lifted, they are no longer strangers in their own land. Collective effervescence, as the French sociologist Émile Durkheim called it in The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, is a state of emotional excitation felt by those who join with others they take to be fellow members of a moral or biological tribe. They gather to affirm their unity, and, united, they feel secure and respected. While Durkheim was studying religious rites among indigenous tribes in Australia and elsewhere, much of what he observed could be applied to the rally at the Lakefront Airport, as well as many others like it. People gather around what Durkheim calls a totem, a symbol such as a cross or a flag. Leaders associate themselves with the totem, and charismatic leaders can become totems themselves. The function of the totem is to unify worshippers. Seen through Durkheim's eyes, the real function of the excited gathering around Donald Trump is to unify all the white evangelical enthusiasts who fear that those cutting ahead in line are about to become a terrible, strange, new America. The source of the awe and excitement isn't simply Trump himself. It is the unity of the great crowd of strangers gathered around him. If the rally itself could speak, it would say, "We are a majority." Added to that is a potent promise to be lifted up from bitterness, despair, depression. The movement, as Trump has increasingly called his campaign, acts as a great antidepressant. Like other leaders promising rescue, Trump evokes a moral consciousness. But what he gives participants, emotionally speaking, is an ecstatic high. The costumes, hats, signs, and symbols reaffirm this new sense of unity. To those who attend his rallies, the event itself symbolizes a larger rising tide. As the crowd exited the hangar, fans were saying to one another, "See how many of us there are?" It felt to them that Trump had captured the flag. One way of reinforcing this high of a united brother and sisterhood of believers is to revile and expel members of out-groups. In his speeches, Trump has spoken of something within Islam which hates Christians, and of his intention to ban all Muslims from entering the country. He has spoken of expelling all undocumented people of Mexican origin, and only reluctantly and in truculent tones, "I repudiate, okay?" Did he repudiate the notorious Louisiana KKK Grand Wizard David Duke, thus signaling blacks as members of an out-group? In nearly every rally, Trump points out a protester, sometimes demonizing them and calling for their expulsion. One protester was even falsely depicted by his campaign as a member of ISIS. Such scapegoating reinforces the joyous unity of the gathering. The act of casting out the bad one helps fans unite in a shared sense of being the good ones, the majority, no longer strangers in their own land. Emotionally speaking, something else very important was going on during the Trump rally. It is another way in which the match strikes dry kindling. Enhancing the elation at the Trump rally was a sense of release from the constrictions of politically correct speech and ideas.
"Let's get rid of PC," Trump calls out.
He was throwing off not only a set of politically correct attitudes, but a set of feeling rules. That is, a set of ideas about the right way to feel regarding blacks, women, immigrants, gays, those alluded to in a sign held by a New Orleans woman protester that said, "Vote with your heart, not with your hate." Those on the far right, I came to know, felt two things. First, they felt the deep story was true. Second, they felt that liberals were saying it was not true, and that they themselves were not feeling the right feelings. Blacks and women who were beneficiaries of affirmative action, immigrants, refugees, and public employees were not really stealing their place in line, liberals said. So don't feel resentful. Obama's help to these groups was not really a betrayal, liberals said. Success of those who cut ahead was not really at the expense of white men and their wives. In other words, the far right felt that the deep story was their real story, and that there was a false PC cover-up of that story. They felt scorned.
"People think we're not good people if we don't feel sorry for blacks and immigrants and Syrian refugees," one man told me. "But I am a good person, and I don't feel sorry for them."
With the cover-up, as my new friends explained to me, came the need to manage the appearance of their real feelings, and even, to some extent, the feelings themselves. They didn't have to do this with friends, neighbors, and family, but they realized that the rest of America did not agree. "I know liberals want us to feel sorry for blacks. I know they think they are so idealistic and we aren't," one woman told me. My friends on the right felt obliged to try to modify their feelings, and they didn't like having to do that. They felt under the watchful eye of the PC police. In the realm of emotions, the right felt like they were being treated as the criminals, and the liberals had the guns. So it was with joyous relief that many heard a Donald Trump who seemed to be wildly, omnipotently, magically free of all PC constraint. He generalized about all Muslims, all Mexicans, all women, including that all women menstruate, a fact Trump declared disgusting. He famously described Fox News newscaster Megyn Kelly as bleeding from whatever. Trump jovially imitated a disabled journalist by physically shaking his arm in imitation of palsy. All deeply derogatory actions in the eyes of Trump's detractors, but liberating to those who had felt constrained to pretend sympathy. Trump allowed them both to feel like a good moral American and to feel superior to those they considered other or beneath them. This giddy, validating release produced a kind of high that felt good. And, of course, people wanted to feel good. The desire to hold on to this elation became a matter of emotional self-interest. Many liberal analysts, myself included, have tended to focus on economic interest. It is a focus on this that had led me, following Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas, to carry the great paradox like a suitcase on my journey through Louisiana. Why, I'd repeatedly asked, with so many problems, was there so much disdain for federal money to alleviate them? These were questions that spoke heavily to economic self-interest. And while economic self-interest is never entirely absent, what I discovered was the profound importance of emotional self-interest. A giddy release from the feeling of being a stranger in one's own land. Having once experienced the elation, the high, of being part of a powerful, like-minded majority, released from politically correct rules of feeling, many wanted to hold on to that elation. To do this, they fended off challenge. They sought affirmation. One woman with whom I spent 6 hours talked about Trump continually, countering possible criticisms, leaving no interstitial moments when skepticism might emerge.